Serial Killing, a podcast, is researched, written, produced, and hosted by me, Alyssa Carroll. This is an independent production, no network, no contracts, and I need your support. Please subscribe, follow on my socials linked below, or go to my Patreon to show your support. Thank you so much.
Hi, listeners. I'm Vanessa Richardson, host of the podcast Serial Killers. Like many of you, I'm fascinated by the darker side of humanity. What causes someone to develop such deadly desires and why they decide to act on them? For the past 6 years, I've been able to explore these curiosities weekly, tapping into the mental states of the world's most notorious killers, examining their backgrounds and habits, searching for answers. If you haven't had a chance to check out our show, there's truly no better time to dive in. With hundreds of episodes to binge and new ones released weekly, Serial Killers is the perfect podcast for any avid true crime fan. Follow Serial Killers on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts.
From about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable.
We are all evil in some form or another. Yes, I am evil. Not 100%, but I am evil.
My mother was a sick, angry, hungry, and very sad woman. I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
This is Serial Killing, a podcast.
Hello again, and welcome to Serial Killing, a podcast, where we sometimes veer off the serial killer path to delve into other topics within our beloved true crime community. Special thanks to my patrons who voted for this episode and who get early access to each podcast. Thank you so much. You are truly appreciated. Today's podcast was voted for by patrons and will be on the famous case of Family Annihilator, Chris Benoit. So let's jump right in. So Christopher Michael Benoit was born on May 21st, 1967 in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. So since we haven't in some time, let's see what's going on in the world during this time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Now, for a little bit of difference, let's look at the cost of living back then, because I know we're all about sick of this horrid economy, right, when it comes to food and housing. So I happened upon a cost of living site, and I found some info. The site chose Sheboygan, Wisconsin, which is north of Milwaukee, but still along the shore of Lake Michigan. Still not New York or LA or the other super expensive parts of the U.S., so I thought it quite reasonable, actually, to use for something average. I don't know how to compare it to the various parts of Europe, Africa, etc., because I've only ever lived here. But in 1967, a newly built home on 2 acres, which is enough room for a very large yard or garden, and if any of you watch my vlogs or follow me on social media, I have just over 1.5 acres, and I have a big vegetable garden, a small greenhouse, a fenced back area for my dogs, and a roomy front yard. So this new house, according to this site, would have 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, 2-car garage, a family room, and a basement or rec room for $35,900. And keep in mind, that's in 1967. So that in today's money would convert to over $300,000 for a house like that. But the average income for, or median income for, people in Wisconsin in 1967 was only about $8,200. That was the yearly income. The median income today for that area is $56,120. So Just for some perspective, I did the math. The math is correct. The math is mathing. The Monterey International Pop Music Festival in California happened in 1967. This was a big one. And it featured some of the big 1960s icons, including Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Janis Joplin, the Steve Miller Band, Simon and Garfunkel, and the Grateful Dead, all of which I have listened to. Also this year, Evel Knievel jumped his motorcycle over 16 cars, 16 lined up in a row. The Beatles released Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which wound up being one of rock's most acclaimed albums. The Beatles also released their Magical Mystery Tour LP, and also released a double A-sided single with Penny Lane on one side and Strawberry Fields Forever on the other side. Now, I was born long after all of this, but I was raised on the Beatles. Now, this is also the year that Elvis Presley married Priscilla. I know there's been some movies about him recently. Otis Redding died in a tragic plane crash this year. He was only 26 years old. But in some exciting news, the first successful human-to-human heart transplant took place in Cape Town, South Africa. So yay, South Africa! The first issue of Rolling Stone magazine was released this year. The most popular music artists this year were The Grateful Dead, Hendrix, Bob Dylan, The Doors, The Bee Gees, Aretha Franklin, David Bowie. Really, they had all the greats around during this time. Canada hosted the World's Fair this year. Expo 67 was hosted by Montreal. To create the 900-acre site, Montreal built new islands and added to existing islands on the St. Lawrence River, where they then built the 90 pavilions. The expo had 62 participating nations and had over 50 million visitors, making it the most successful World's Fair of the 20th century. So yay, Canada! There were some teachers striking for a cost of living raise and more power to them. So, kind of sidebar, but if we want to solve the education crisis in the U.S., at least, I don't know how they're treated elsewhere, then pay teachers a handsome salary, a handsome one. Hear me out. You will get a much more competitive market. Better qualified and better suited people will want to be teachers. And then we can weed out the ones who aren't bothering to try anymore. You know, they just assign shit and then put their feet up on their desk sort of thing. Because if there really weren't any teachers, you know what I'm saying? Like, let's treat teachers better. We'll get better, more patient and qualified people to be teachers. Off the soapbox. So all in all, nothing too horrible really going on in the world news. So I'd say any external stressors with regards to the news or whatever wouldn't have negatively affected Chris's mother's pregnancy. Chris's parents were Michael and Margaret Benoit. I really could not find anything out about his parents, but they certainly seemed perfectly normal people. At some point when Chris was still very little, the family, which also at some point added a sister, Lori, moved to Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. It is also important to note that Chris could speak fluent English and French. Most impressive. In a case report regarding issues after his death, which we will obviously get into some detail a bit later, they spoke about Chris's childhood. In that case report, it was said that he was born healthy and happy with no medical or mental health issues. But at the tender age of 6 years old, he was riding in a car in the front seat with no seatbelt, because this would have been back before they made it a law to wear them. Most people didn't. There was a car accident, and Chris hit his head on the inside of the windshield, and he had to be hospitalized for 3 days. It is thought that he suffered a mild traumatic brain injury. However, he didn't seem to display any symptoms or signs of permanent damage or issues. He seemed to be good after, but it happened. We're in this community together. We know it's noteworthy. Now, from a young age, Chris absolutely loved professional wrestling. From childhood through his adolescence, it was said that his favorite wrestlers were the Dynamite Kid and Bret Hart. After he was able to attend a professional wrestling performance, he was hooked. Chris himself would later say, quote, "I just idolized him. We had backyard wrestling matches, or I would be in my room kicking my bed trying to clone him. I remember now he and Bret Hart stood out above everyone else," end quote. And one such story coming out of his childhood fascination with wrestling is that he actually lost a tooth when he was pretending to wrestle with his dog as a kid. Dog was a Rottweiler, I believe I read. The dog's face hit him in the jaw. They were just messing around. Dog wasn't trying to hurt him, but a tooth was knocked out. He never had a tooth inserted because he thought he would lose it again anyway when he started his wrestling career. And I found that kind of interesting. So at around 12 years old, all sources said that Chris started seriously working out to bulk up. This is 12 years old. And he played sports as well. It was said that he played football during his upper school years as a defensive end and actually played for 5 years. In an ABC News interview, his father, Michael, would later say, quote, "He was pretty much driven from the age of 12, 13 to get in the wrestling industry. Chris lifted weights every day. He was 13 years old, breaking records in high school in our basement," end quote. It is also important to note that while he was wrestling in his free time and playing sports, most usually football, he did not experience any or had any known head injuries, no missed practices or games due to any injury, and it was also said that there was no known drug or alcohol issues in his teens. Another interesting fun fact is that Chris actually trained to become a professional wrestler in the famous Hart Dungeon by the late Stu Hart, who was the father of Bret Hart, one of Chris's idols, if you remember. And in fact, one of Chris's signature moves, the sharpshooter, was a move that Chris trademarked in his arsenal of wrestling moves he would use growing up as a wrestler. It's a move where they cross their opponent's legs behind them and then proceed to bend their legs backwards behind them for the visual, like you're just bent wrong. In high school specifically, he won numerous awards in wrestling and bodybuilding, and it was said that he had an unwavering focus on becoming a world-class wrestler. Sources said that he went to the Archbishop O'Leary Catholic High School in Edmonton, and that's where he graduated. And that was his childhood. I was kind of surprised that that was all I could find about his childhood, but that can be pretty telling in that maybe there just wasn't that much to report. It would seem that he had a comfortable childhood, sibling to grow up with, no abuse, no neglect. Mom and dad were married, in the house, they were supportive of his passions. Other than one move when he was very, very young, there was no uprooting and having to make all new friends and reestablishing himself within all the new peer groups, right? We heard nothing about him being withdrawn or isolated, no bullying. I didn't read anything about him being a bully either. It would seem that he knew what he wanted to do when he was grown at an earlier age than I certainly did. He was very active, he played sports, he wrestled, he just seemed to have laser focus on what he wanted, and he took all of the steps to get himself there, personal accountability. The only mention of any negative, really anything, was the head injury when he was 6 years old from the car crash. He did have to stay in the hospital for 3 days, and that's nothing to scoff at. Could there have been some damage? Possibly. And what part of his head would he have most likely hit on the windshield? The front or front top, the frontal lobe, and parietal lobe. So very quickly, the frontal lobe, as we talk about often, is responsible for planning, problem solving, motivation, judgment, decision making, impulse control, social behavior, personality, memory, learning, reward, and attention. Many of the criminals we talk about have issues in this region, being understimulated or damaged, what have you. The parietal lobe is responsible, that's the more front top. The parietal lobe is responsible for receiving and processing sensory information such as touch, pressure, heat, cold, and pain. The parietal lobes are also involved in the perception of body awareness and the building of a spatial mental map to represent the world around us. So I call that knowing your four corners, you know, like.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Being able to drive in reverse and know that your back bumper is not going to hit, you know, you can visualize that. You can see how far you need to go without standing there. Okay? But again, I don't really want to put too much weight on that injury. But we can't 100% completely discount it, okay? I couldn't find anything talking about him having any lingering issues from that at all. Not every head injury will result in issues. I had my head nearly through a windshield myself, and I'm fine, right? Moving on. So there just wasn't much to analyze there. If any of you who might have known him in his youth want to share any experiences with him or about him, please feel free to share with us. I'd be happy to update everyone with additional info, but as of this recording, there really just wasn't any issues with him that I could find. High school, he kept busy with sports and wrestling, and he had his dream. He fully intended to be a professional wrestler as his career, and that's it. It's actually kind of nice to research and see that he was a perfectly normal kid with no known issues and no maltreatment. It's kind of nice. So let's get back into it. Now, it was said that young 18-year-old Chris Benoit actually started his professional wrestling career in 1985 in the, quote, Stampede Wrestling promotion. His adoration for Bret Hart as well as Tom Billington's wrestling style became quite apparent as he emulated their signature moves, such as, again, the sharp shooter, the diving headbutt, very dangerous one, and the snap suplex to, quote, instill fear in the hearts of his opponents. Now, I don't know much about wrestling, I'm not going to pretend I do, but those who know, know, and the rest of us just imagine whatever we see when we're surfing channels and we run into the station where people are wrestling. But he showed a rather impressive endurance, and due to his ferocious speed and physical strength, he earned the nickname Dynamite after one of his idols. According to Chris himself, in his first match, he attempted the diving headbutt move before learning how to land correctly and had the wind knocked out of him. He said that he didn't really want to use that move again after that point, but I'm not sure if he did. So it must have scared him to a decent degree at least. But it is important to note that he very quickly became one of the best wrestlers in Stampede after his debut that year in Calgary, Alberta. The first title Chris ever won was the Stampede British Commonwealth Mid-Heavyweight Championship in March of 1988 against Gamma Singh when he was 21 years old. Oh, and also in 1988, Chris married his girlfriend, Martina. And it should come as no surprise that his run in Stampede turned out to be very successful and earned him enough credibility to be considered for bigger wrestling leagues. During his initial period in Stampede, he ended up winning a total of 4 British Commonwealth titles as well as 4 international tag team titles. In 1989, he left the Stampede Wrestling group and actually moved clear over to Japan to join the New Japan Pro Wrestling, the NJPW. It was said that Chris spent about a year training with the younger Japanese wrestlers to improve his abilities. While in the dojo, he spent months doing strenuous exercise and floor sweeping before he actually stepped into the ring. He made his Japanese debut in 1986 under his real name. 3 years later, he started wearing a mask and took on the name The Pegasus Kid. Now, Chris said numerous times that he originally hated that mask, but it did eventually become a part of him. While with the NJPW, he really blossomed, came into his own as a performer in critically acclaimed matches with other, you know, well-known Japanese wrestlers in their junior heavyweight division. So throughout the early 90s, he established himself in NJPW by winning the Best of Super Juniors tournament twice and also winning in the Super J Cup tournament. Early in the 90s, he kept wrestling in Japan, but then, you know, he kind of began expanding and he was playing in Mexico and Europe, and he ended up winning a few championship titles. But it was when he made his return to North America that his career really began to take off and his popularity increased. But it is important to note that it was also around this time that people began talking about his aggressive and pretty rough style of wrestling and that he liked the contact aspect of what he was doing. In 1993, Chris and Martina welcomed their first child, a son they named David. So as his career was on its upward trajectory, he was wrestling around 250 days a year. Chris spent a brief period of time in WCW between 92 and 93 before going to ECW in 94. Now, during the summer of 95, Chris had WWF tryout matches against names like Bob Holly, Adam Bomb, and Owen Hart. He returned to WCW in the fall of 95 and became a member of the legendary Four Horsemen stable. Now, even I have at least heard of the Four Horsemen. He had finally hit the big time. He was becoming a household name. He was making good money. He had a wife, he had a child, and in 97, he and Martina welcomed their second child, Megan, in 1997. Only Martina found out that Chris had been having an affair with another wrestler's wife while she was pregnant. The marriage was over not too long after Megan was born. Chris then moved in with Nancy Sullivan, who would become his second wife. Nancy and her husband were already living separate lives when she and Chris began their affair, and that's according to Kevin Sullivan, Nancy's ex-husband. But remember, Chris's marriage was not basically over when he began his affair. So in 2000, the now 33-year-old Chris made the move from WCW to WWF, World Wrestling Federation, which later went through a name change to WWE because of the initials of the name being the same as the World Wildlife Foundation. It was a whole thing. I do kind of remember that. Regardless, back in the day, the WWF was the big time. The most famous of the famous wrestlers worked under the then WWF. 2000 was also the year that Chris and Nancy welcomed their son, Daniel, into the world. The couple bought a house in Fayetteville, Georgia, which is a short distance south of Atlanta, Georgia. Their house wasn't like this huge sprawling mansion by the looks of it, but it was nicer than I'll ever own for sure. It looked to be mostly kind of American craftsman style with perhaps a bit of farmhouse vibes. The new family settled in, and Chris continued with his wrestling career. Since this is about true crime and not a list of his wrestling accomplishments, suffice it to say that he became one of the more famous wrestlers. And with that kind of fame and that many matches, injuries are going to happen. With all of that abuse that he did to his own body physically, sources stated that he suffered many undiagnosed concussions, his father actually mentioning 15 specifically, and one wrestling opponent knocked him out completely unconscious. That is a lot of head trauma. In 2003, we begin to see some changes in mental health. Domestic life wasn't particularly working out for him. Nancy filed for divorce, stating domestic abuse, but apparently dropped it after 3 months. She had also filed a restraining order, but later dropped that as well. Then in 2005, Chris's best friend and really basically brother, fellow wrestler Eddie Guerrero, was found dead in a hotel room by his own nephew. His autopsy revealed he died of acute heart failure due to underlying cardiovascular disease. He was 38 years old. To say that Chris was devastated doesn't really describe it. It was said that when he found out, he sobbed uncontrollably. And after that, his friends said he became rather hermit-like. Another famous wrestler, Chris Jericho, I think most of us have heard of him, said that Chris took Eddie's loss like that of someone losing their spouse. Also in 2005, apparently Chris kept journals, and they showed that he was aware that he was depressed and having lapses in his memory. And it really shouldn't come as a shock that it was highly suggested that he had been using anabolic steroids to help, you know, boost his career. Most people know what this is and what it does, but for those that don't, anabolic steroids are drugs made in a lab that mimic the naturally occurring male sex hormones called androgens. Testosterone is the primary type of androgen. Doctors prescribe anabolic steroids to promote the growth of skeletal muscle and the development of male sexual characteristics for conditions such as low testosterone, certain cancers, or acquired immunodeficiency syndrome or AIDS, which we don't hear about too much now. Around 3 to 4 million people in the U.S. use anabolic steroids without a prescription for non-medical purposes. They're the most commonly used as appearance and performance-enhancing drugs. Some athletes and bodybuilders may use them as a way to enhance their physical appearance, and by some, we all know a higher number than is ever advertised. I don't want to name drop. Possible side effects are acne, oily skin, ankle swelling, problems urinating, breast enlargement in men, reduced breast size in women, worsening of sleep apnea, decreased testicle size, vaginal dryness, itching, etc., and changes in menstrual cycles. Also, high blood pressure, blood clots, heart issues. Could that have been what killed his friend? Stroke, liver damage, short stature, okay, male baldness, aggression, mania, delusions, and major depressive disorder. That is a heavy list. Don't do anabolic steroids if you're just trying to pump up your athletic stuff. Just fucking don't do that. Nearly one-third of people who misuse anabolic steroids become dependent on them. That means over time it starts to take higher and more frequent doses to get the same effects. People who become dependent on anabolic steroids can also have withdrawal symptoms if they stop taking them. Without the drug in their system, they may feel tired, restless, they may stop eating, stop sleeping, lose their sex drive, and crave the drug. In some cases, withdrawal causes depression and thoughts of suicide. He was racking up innumerable injuries to his body and had to have spinal surgery. And with all of this, it is also thought pretty seriously that he developed an addiction to prescription narcotics, you know, pain pills. Another surgery in 2006 and some level of, quote, official treatment for depression as well. This is 2006, okay? So, on June 19th, 2007, Chris professionally wrestled for the last time. He defeated his opponent to go on to battle in the ECW World Championship that was happening on June 24th, 5 days later. Before this championship, he had a few small appearances, only he called and said that he couldn't make it because his son and wife were puking up blood due to food poisoning. But then he didn't show up to a pay-per-view match. That was quite concerning. The audience was told that he was unable to make his appearance because of a family emergency, and the crowd reportedly chanted his name during the entire match. But on that day, June 22nd, Chris had made other plans. That Friday evening, and we don't know the trigger or what led up to it, we know that Chris used duct tape and cables to bind his wife's arms and legs. They believed a balled-up sock with tape mixed in it was used as a gag on her. They found it in the trash. It had a lot of dried, soaked blood into it. Nancy's back told the story of how Chris had used his knee to push her back, curve it forward, while he strangled her by pulling backward on another cord. And that is how she died. It was then believed he wrapped her in a blanket and put a Bible beside her body. Her autopsy found just a tiny bit of alcohol in her system, though they said that could have been a byproduct of decomposition. She had a couple of prescriptions in her system, but at the exact prescribed amounts. In no way had she been drugged or had been drinking beyond maybe, say, a half a glass of wine and maybe no alcohol at all when she was murdered. They found 6-year-old Daniel in his bedroom. He, too, had been strangled, and it was found in his autopsy that it appeared he had been sedated before he was murdered. Sources said that he was given Xanax. He had internal injuries to his throat, but there wasn't any bruising, surprisingly. Chris also placed a Bible beside Daniel's body. And with regards to which Chris murdered first, it is believed that he killed Nancy first because she was more decomposed than Daniel was, albeit slightly. But unlike most murderers, he didn't run. He stayed at home. But on the evening of the 24th, nearly 48 hours after he had murdered his wife, he unalived himself by hanging himself from some of his exercise equipment. He was 40 years old. They were discovered the next day. So Nancy had been dead for 3 days, Daniel 2 days, and Chris just 1. So when they were discovered, of course, everyone wanted to know what the motive was. So to get this out of the way, though this really wouldn't have been a motive, his son did not have any condition that was stunting his growth, okay? No condition causing delayed cognitive development. His own teachers said he was on par with the other students and his size was average for his age. He also didn't have track marks in his arms due to his parents injecting him with growth hormones. All of the family and people said that that was a lie. It's not true. So that one is off the table. I mean, not that it was a motive, but you get what I'm saying. Some said that, of course, the marriage had had some rough times. No one was disputing that. There were whispers that Nancy suspected Chris of having an affair with another female wrestler. Some said it was all of that head trauma that did it. Others blamed it on the steroids. I think it was all of those, but I think a report citing the autopsy says it all. So I'm going to read some of it to you, and here we go. This is coming from muchnick.net, muchnick.net. Be careful. It says, this is a scan of an actual sort of review of the autopsy. And it says in big black letters, autopsy. At autopsy, the decedent was a well-developed, well-nourished, muscular, 5-foot, 11-inch man whose appearance was consistent with the stated age of 40 years. There were multiple abrasions of all 4 extremities. There was a tight, single-looped rope ligature around the neck slipped through a white metal carabiner, C-A-R-A-B-I-N-E-R. Adjacent to that was a black ball attached to the rope. The carabiner and ball were on the right lateral neck. Underneath the rope ligature was a white towel, which was wrapped around the neck twice and taped to itself. There was a 0.6 to 1.3 centimeter in width, dry, leathery, and tan ligature indentation circumferentially situated around the neck. The ligature indentation was situated in a transverse fashion on the anterior neck and was situated in a transverse oblique ascending fashion on each side of the neck before ascending behind the ears to the rostral mid-posterior neck. There were 3.6 centimeters in diameter dry abrasions of the anterior neck. And internally, there were no fractures of the hyoid bone or thyroid cartilage or hemorrhage in the soft tissues of the anterior or posterior neck. So he did not snap his neck when he unalived himself. The brain appeared grossly normal, was sectioned in a fresh state, discarded, was later retrieved from the body and saved in formalin. There was evidence of surgical hardware in the cervical spine, so we know that he had spine surgery. There was cardiomegaly, I probably mispronounced that, with left ventricular hypertrophy and a bilateral atrioventricular dilation. The liver and spleen weighed 2,620 grams and 300 grams, respectively. Grossly, the testes appeared normal in size and shape. However, microscopic examination of the testes revealed atrophy of the seminiferous tubules, thickened basement membranes, and interstitial edema with arrest of germ cell maturation. Toxicologic analysis of his blood revealed alprazolam and hydrocodone. Post-mortem toxicologic analysis of his urine revealed an elevated level of testosterone, with an elevated testosterone to epitestosterone ratio, which indicated an exogenous source of testosterone. The underlying cause of death was determined to be asphyxiation due to hanging, and the manner of death was determined to be the S word. So now we're getting into the forensic neuropathology. This is the part that is the most interesting to me. The brain was initially cut in the fresh state during the autopsy and placed back into the truncal cavity for cremation. Following efforts made by the authors, consent was obtained from the next of kin to partially decomposed brain pieces were later retrieved from the truncal cavity by the forensic pathologist and submitted for neuropathologic analysis. Cut sections of the brain containing the mesial temporal lobe, amygdala, and hippocampus were not identified and were not submitted for neuropathologic examination. These sections most probably were inadvertently left inside the body and possibly were cremated with the body. One irregular piece of dorsal dura mater and 29 irregularly cut coronal, transverse, and oblique sections of the formalin-fixed brain were retrieved. I know, that's a lot of medical mumbo-jumbo. And really, the rest of the article is sort of so medical, medically termed, sprinkled with big, big words that are hard to pronounce for anyone who don't use them every single day. So let me get to a more lay-term situation here, okay? So it says that the medical examiner believed that Daniel was sedated before he was murdered. Okay, so Chris was found to have Xanax, hydrocodone, and an elevated level of testosterone caused by a synthetic form of the hormone in his system. The chief medical examiner attributed the testosterone level to Benoit possibly being treated for a deficiency caused by previous steroid abuse or testicular insufficiency. There was no indication of anything in Chris's body contributing to his violent behavior that led to the murder-suicide, concluding that there was really no roid rage involved. Prior to the murder-suicide, he had been illegally given medications not in compliance with WWE's Talent Wellness Program in February of 06, and it was said that during the investigation, it was uncovered that other wrestlers had also been given steroids. So after the double murder-suicide, neuroscientist and retired professional wrestler Christopher Nowinski contacted Michael Benoit, who was Chris's father, suggesting that years of trauma to his son's brain may have led to his actions. Tests were conducted on Chris's brain by a doctor, the head of neurosurgery at West Virginia University. The results showed that, quote, Benoit's brain was so severely damaged, it resembled the brain of an 85-year-old Alzheimer's patient, end quote. He was reported to have an advanced form of dementia similar to the brains of four retired NFL players who had multiple concussions, sank into depression, and harmed themselves or others. This doctor and his colleagues concluded that repeated concussions can lead to dementia, which can contribute to severe behavioral problems. I mean, that's logical. We all know that. Benoit's father suggests that brain damage may have been the leading cause. Once the details of his actions became apparent, the WWE made the decision to remove nearly all mentions of Chris Benoit from their website, future broadcasts, and all other publications. Now, some other testing was done, okay? Other tests conducted on Benoit's brain tissue revealed severe chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, and damage to all four lobes of the brain and brain stem. The doctor and his colleagues concluded that repeated concussions can lead to dementia, which can contribute to severe behavioral problems. Again, this was thought to be the leading cause of his murder-suicide. But chronic traumatic encephalopathy is also not a joke. Damage to all four lobes of the brain and his brain stem. So that kind of leaves things sort of cut and dry, or maybe, you know, close the book on that one as to how this possibly happened. His wrestling career is how this happened. So Chris was cremated, but where his ashes are is a mystery, as far as I could find. Nancy and Daniel were cremated and the ashes are with family in Florida. And let's not forget that Chris had two other children from his first marriage. As far as I could find, they are alive and well. I don't want to harass them. Bless them. Chris's friends and co-workers, so to speak, were shocked, stating that he was just a really great guy. This, you know, they never would have imagined him doing that. This really drives home the issue with repeated head trauma, which I believe, again, was the biggest issue. And then, of course, the steroids. So, it's a very, very tragic case. Now, I did not grow up watching wrestling. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I do recognize his name, definitely. I know that he did wrestle John Cena. We all know who John Cena is. So this guy was no joke. You know, he wasn't some kind of up and coming. He was a big deal. And everyone talked about how, you know, that he was just an awesome guy. Head trauma is a huge issue. So what do you think about this case? Leave me a comment. You can DM me on Instagram. It's just @serial_killing. Come join the Facebook fan page that a listener created. We finally hit 700 people, so we are doing a giveaway. That one's just Serial Killing, a podcast fan page on Facebook. We do, you know, educational things and articles and videos and such, but we also do pretty funny memes and we have a good time over there. Outside of that, guys, thank you so much for listening, because I know you could be listening to anyone else, but you chose me. And I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, guys. Have a great day.
Yeah, anybody who killed more than two or three people was a mass murderer. And whether it was all at one place or over an extended period of time, and then in the early 80s, they came up with this differentiation called serial killing.